Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. In 1897, Franz Boas published The Social Organization and the Secret Societies of the Kwakiutl Indians, one of the most influential books of in the history of anthropology. It was based upon his research and interviews with the Kwakiutl, a Pacific Northwest Coast indigenous people, and included extensive contributions by George Hunt, his indigenous research partner. The Bard Graduate Center on West 86th Street is currently presenting an exhibition that highlights Boas's and Hunt's original field work and explores contemporary Kwakiutl life. The exhibition, which is called The Story Box, features ceremonial objects as well as rare archival photographs, drawings, and manuscripts. Joining us now are its curator, Aaron Glass, and Corrine Hunt, who is both the designer of the exhibit and the great-granddaughter of George Hunt. Welcome to our show.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
Thank you.
Corrine, can you tell us a little about the Kwakiutl people?
Well, right now I'm in the village of Takis, Fort Rupert, which is where George Hunt was from and where I live at the moment.
That's in British Columbia?
That's in British Columbia in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so we're a First Nations group who have potlatched that's part of our culture. And part of the book is outlining what we did in our potlatch ceremony.
Now, why does Boas refer to them as the Kwakiutl? Is that term incorrect?
It's sort of a general term that was used to describe the people in a geographical area. The village that I'm in is where the Kwagil, lived, as well as 3 other tribes, but the central tribe here was the Kwagil tribe, so that's why he's referring to it.
And Kwagil is, I don't see that in any of this. That's just how you pronounce
Kwakiutl.
Kwakiutl is an anglicized way of pronouncing Kwagiulf. Uh-huh. And people like Boas and other early ethnographers and Indian administrators, when they met other people from the larger region who spoke the same language as the Kwagiulf in Fort Rupert, they assumed they were also Kwagiulf. So they called them Kwakiutl. So the term Kwakwakiwak means those who speak Kwakwala, and it's a more encompassing term for all of the related people who speak the same language.
So they identify themselves with their language.
The term means the speakers of Kwakwala.
Corrine, how far back can you trace your family history?
Generations and generations and generations. The village here nearby was dated to 8,000 years.
Wow. How large is the Kwakiutl population today?
The general population? I'm not sure. Maybe 10,000. The village here that I'm living in has about 250 people.
And do they all speak the original language, or have they been anglicized or Canadian-sized?
Yeah, unfortunate. there was a ban of our ceremonies for quite some period, 75 or 80 years, and the language was prohibited for a time as well. So it's caused a great strain on the number of speakers. My father is a fluent speaker, but I am not.
And we'll go into that in more detail in a little while, but I want to cover the backstory a bit with Aaron. Franz Boas was born and educated in Germany. How did he come to be known as the father of American anthropology?
So Boas did his schooling in Germany. He did his doctoral work there. And as part of his doctoral field work, he didn't get a degree in anthropology. You could not at that time in the early 1880s get a degree in anthropology.
It wasn't considered a real science?
No, it just hadn't been invented yet. Mm-hmm. People were ethnologists and they studied other cultures, but it wasn't a degree that you could get in a university. So Boas's doctoral degree was actually in physics and geography. And as part of his field work for that, he spent some time in the Eastern Arctic in Canada on Baffin Island working with the Inuit. And he became very interested in other cultures and working with indigenous cultures in particular. Back in Berlin in 1885, he was exposed to a very large museum collection from British Columbia that somebody else had made in previous years. It sparked his imagination. And in 1886, he pretty much self-financed a research trip to British Columbia. And on that trip, basically decided that he was going to work with people in the Northwest Coast, and that he wanted to emigrate to America. I think as a German Jew, he felt his opportunities in Germany were going to be limited in academia, and he had an uncle who already lived in New York, and so very quickly decided to emigrate to America.
But when you say America, was it Canada where these indigenous people were, or was it the United States? Because I associate him with the United States.
Yeah, no, he started doing his research in British Columbia in Canada, but he decided to move to the United States and actually ended up settling down here in New York long before he was hired at the Museum of Natural History, where he sort of made a name for himself.
The social organization and the secret societies of the Kwakiutl Indians was published in 1897. What are some of the topics it covers?
Well, it sets out to describe what the title lays out. The first quarter of the book, third of the book, really focuses on Kwakiutl social organization. So that is especially the kinship systems, the way people were organized into extended lineages, which he called clans, kind of colloquially. And so he describes how the kinship system works, how people were organized politically.
Religious traditions, I assume.
Well, and a bit about the potlatch, which Corinne mentioned, and I'm sure we'll talk more about. And then the bulk of the book is more about what he called the secret societies, which was a kind of term of the art in anthropology at the time, although one that didn't describe anything very clearly in particular. So among the Kwakiutl, there are these hereditary dance societies that people inherit rights to be members of. And these dance societies use certain masks and sing songs and have stories. And that's really what he means when he says secret societies, but it was these dance societies that structured ceremonial life year round. And that's what he really describes in great detail in the most of the book.
And how was it received in the academic community of the time? You say there was no, anthropology wasn't considered an academic field of study.
The book came out right at the moment that Boas took up his curatorial position at the American Museum of Natural History. And it had enormous influence in museums and in anthropology. I would say initially in museums. We know, and we have a feature about this in the exhibition, within a couple years of its being published, the Smithsonian Institution, which published it, the U.S. National Museum, sent copies to museums all over North America and Europe to establish, I think, their preeminence as an American hub for anthropology, ethnology, but also to help establish Boas's career. And other museums very quickly started using it as a guide to make their own Northwest Coast collections. We know we have a display in the exhibit that shows how the Field Museum in Chicago, the Milwaukee Public Museum, copied images straight out of the book for their own displays. So it really had circulation among scholars and museum people very quickly.
And the book has wonderful illustrations.
Yes.
To me, the area evokes the totem poles, but was the totem pole a big part of the culture?
Absolutely. There are some totem poles featured, especially early in the book, in the social organization part, because totem poles primarily display family crests. They're heraldic poles, and so they're tied specifically into the lineage structure, and they were put up in front of people's houses to advertise people's identity.
Corinne, it sounded like you wanted to join the conversation. Join in anytime you want.
Okay, thank you.
Did you have something that you wanted to add to that?
Our family here, where I'm standing, we have a totem pole. Mm-hmm. And there are many still in the village that represents our families, yeah.
And how do you read the totem pole?
Well, it depends on the poles, but the pole that we have represents, it's a memorial pole for four of my brothers who passed away. So the pole relates our respect for my brothers.
Mm-hmm. And then
others.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, and others, you know, they might depict, for example, another one here is depicting our great-great-grandmother who came from Alaska, who was George Hunt's mother. So we have an Alaskan relative, and so in our village we have a pole that represents her travels here to Fort Rupert and George Hunt and our legacy, I guess.
Was his mother a Native American?
Yeah, she was a Tlingit from Alaska, and his father was an Englishman, and they met and came and lived in this village.
Was that a rarity to have that kind of mixed marriage at that time?
I don't know. It wasn't really. The Onislaga, George Hunt's mother, was a Tlingit noblewoman, and their family marriages were part of a strengthening the tribe. So marrying Robert Hunt was, a strategic marriage, but they had 10 children and it was a strong marriage. George Hunt was actually half white and half Tlingit and then born into a Quaggilt village.
So Robert Hunt was worked for the Hudson's Bay Company. He was a fur trader, basically a merchant. And so I think especially marriages between fur traders and Hudson's Bay Company employees in the middle of the 19th century were very common to high-ranking Native women as ways of creating strong economic and social ties between chiefs and the traders that were in their territories.
This is Leonard Lopit at Large on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. Aaron, how did in the 19th century, wasn't the dominant theory of anthropology what's now called cultural or scientific racism?
Yes, and
was it tied to eugenics in any way?
Later on in the 20th century, yes. So one of the reasons that this book was important and one of the reasons that Franz Boas was so pivotal a figure establishing anthropology as an academic discipline in North America was that he was an adamant opponent of what we now call scientific racism. In the late 19th century, the dominant kind of theory of in comparative ethnology and thinking cross-culturally about people especially non-European peoples, was variations on theories of what was also called social Darwinism. So drawing on Darwinian theories of biological evolution, comparative ethnologists posited theories of social or cultural evolution. And it was assumed that all of humanity progressed along a single linear course from savage to civilized, from simple to complex. And you could, the idea was that you could plot any peoples from all time, from anywhere on Earth, along this single trajectory, which ended up with, you know, Northern Europeans at the end point of human evolution. And onto that was mapped the geography that people lived on, their physiological makeup. That's where sort of theories of race and racial difference comes in. And
justifications for colonialism and all sorts of other things
that
Europeans imposed on the world.
Absolutely, it was a kind of academic theory that drove all sorts of kind of political ideologies, and Boas was adamantly against this. Boas, from the very beginning of his career, and that's where this book was really important, not because he laid out this as a theory in the book, but he used the research and the very detailed research on the Kukwakiwok in the book to show the cultural complexity of the Kukwakiwok and to really argue that indigenous peoples and their cultures have to be taken seriously on their own terms, that they're not just simple versions of what became civilization. And this was really what emerged out of this in Boas's work, was the notion of cultural relativism, cultural relativity, that we could only understand any aspect of culture relative to a people's kind of entire holistic way of being.
And was that influential at the time? Did it change the way people who later came to be known as anthropologists viewed the world?
Absolutely. He instituted this sort of theory of culture when he became a professor of anthropology at Columbia, the first professor of anthropology at Columbia University, when he left the Museum of Natural History. This was in 1905, 1906. And he taught the first generation of anthropologists in North America, Alfred Kroeber, Ruth Benedict, Margaret Mead, Melville Herskovitz. Zora Neale Hurston studied with him. And that's why he's called the father of American anthropology.
Well, that's an impressive list of
students. Absolutely. And with that, he established not only these notions of cultural relativism and that indigenous cultures have to be respected and taken seriously on their own terms, but also that the proper methodology for anthropology was fieldwork, that to know other peoples, you had to live with them and speak their language. And he institutionalized that mode of fieldwork as the method of anthropology.
And that's become the standard ever since.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of the people who were proponents of these sort of evolutionary theories didn't do that. They sat in their armchairs and they compiled data coming back from missionaries and explorers, and they plotted that information on these a priori charts of civilization. And Boas just thought that was the completely wrong way to do things. And then there were museological ramifications, which we could come back to.
Well, missionaries, of course, have their own agendas. So the information they're sending back have certain biases attached. The better way, Boas obviously understood, was to go and live with these people. But how much of the language could he learn? This is a complicated language.
Boas was while he wasn't trained in linguistics per se, he did receive training in comparative philology in Germany. And he was just a kind of natural born linguist. He learned a lot of the language. But this is, George Hunt becomes an important part of the story here, because one of Boas's both theoretical and methodological the points that he emphasized as a way to help control cultural bias in understanding other people, you had to work very closely with cultural insiders who could not only record information, but help to do the linguistic and cultural translation that meant that ethnologists were accurately understanding what it was that Native people were doing and saying. And for Boas, George Hunt was that key local insider,
and
translator.
Corinne, when did Boas meet George Hunt?
Actually, Aaron knows more about that, but was that in 1890?
The first documented meeting of them that we know of was in 1889, very brief meeting. Boas likely heard of George Hunt when he first went to British Columbia in 1886, but we don't think they met yet. They met briefly in 1889, and they really got to know each other in 1893 at the Chicago World's Fair, which I think we'll talk about.
That'll be definitely part of this story. Did you ever meet your great-grandfather?
No. He died in 1933, so I did not get a chance to meet him. I wish. I really do.
Didn't he grow up speaking both English and the Kiwak language?
I understand that he grew up speaking the Tlingit language and English, and learned the Kwakwaka'wakw language later, but he must have had quite a talent for languages, because he seemed quite fluent in all three.
He probably also spoke Chinook jargon, which was a language that Native people used all up and down the coast to trade with one another. And then the early fur traders often learned it also as a means to trade with various different people who they couldn't learn all of the Native languages. And so it's very likely that George spoke Chinook jargon also.
So that made him the ideal translator.
Absolutely.
When Boas and Hunt worked together, how did they divide the tasks?
Well, that changed a little bit over the three or four decades that they worked together. Initially, Boas hired George Hunt to make a museum collection for the Chicago World's Fair. And then,
was it intended for those artifacts to go back? Because that has become an issue more recently. All of the Brooklyn Museum has a great collection of Native American artifacts, and there are an awful lot of people in the tribes that they were taken from who say, we want them back.
We should come back to the issue of repatriation, because it is a part of the exhibit, and it's a very important part of the story of the Umista Cultural Center, the Kwakwaka'wakw Museum that worked with us on producing this exhibit. So let's come back to the repatriation. But Boas hired Hunt initially to make a big collection for display at the Chicago World's Fair, and then that collection was absorbed into the Field Museum in Chicago, which came out of the World's Fair. And then at the World's Fair, Boas trained Hunt to write Kwakwala in a linguistically accurate phonetic orthography. And after the fair, Boas started hiring Hunt not only to collect objects, but also to collect stories and language. And then over the rest
And he was paying him?
Yeah, absolutely. George was a sort of paid assistant for Boas for decades. And in fact, as he got on in life, it's arguable that George Hunt became a kind of almost full-time ethnographer, working for Boas, a few other people also, that he, especially in his latter decades, really made a living out of being an ethnologist.
Could Boas have conducted his work, interviewing people, observing ceremonies and other things, without the assistance of Hunt and Hunt's explanations?
So he did work in other communities. He did work in other places without George as an intermediary. But the work that Boas is most famous for, starting with this book and then a series of other publications that Boas and Hunt worked on together, George was absolutely central to. And in fact, part of the goal of our exhibition and the larger collaborative project that the exhibition is a part of is really to say that George Hunt co-authored these books with Boas, and the level of detailed understanding that Boas achieved is very hard to imagine without George Hunt having been not only a translator and a facilitator, but also a co-author of writing the manuscripts that ended up getting published.
So why didn't Boas give him full credit as a co-author?
It's a very interesting question. It's one our research team asks itself all the time. And I think it has something to do at this early moment with Boaz needing to establish his own authority in the field. You know, he shows up as a young anthropologist in North America, takes on the establishment, tells the most famous anthropologists in North America that their whole understanding of the field and their museum displays are completely wrong. He wants a job here, and he needed to establish his ethnographic authority, his bona fides for being an anthropologist. And so in the title page of the book, he famously acknowledges Hunt for having provided notes, but he doesn't talk about the complexity of Hunt's own identity, which Corrine has talked about, and he doesn't really disclose how much of the book was really authored by Hunt. Later on, he does publish books that are authored by Franz Boas and George Hunt. So he goes back and forth on that. But my sense is that he needs to establish his own authority as an anthropologist, even while he's acknowledging the importance of his indigenous sources.
Would you say that Boas and Hunt had a genuine friendship as well as a working partnership?
The textual record suggests that much of what we know about their relationship over the decades that they worked together comes from their correspondence. They wrote to one another weekly, monthly for 3 decades. And based on the correspondence alone, there seems to have been a lot of affection between them. Even while Boas was clearly Hunt's employer, Boas stayed with Hunt's family. Hunt came to New York and stayed with Boas here in New York for a period of time. And they wrote letters, warm letters, back and forth to one another when somebody's family member died. And I'd love to hear from Corrine about what her thoughts on this are from the community side rather than from the archive.
And is this something that has even been discussed within the community?
Oh, we've discussed our grandfather quite often. my dad often, he was 4 when George died, but you know, there's so much archival memories of George and films and other things that we can see. His legacy here is quite profound, and the book that we're talking about is really become a sort of important place where we go to see what it was like back in 1897, you know, what the world for us was like. So it's kind of interesting to be able to look back and see the kind of ceremonies that happened, the depth and the width of the culture, but to know that culture exists today. And that's, I think, a really important part of this, that the book itself becomes a tool for us to use in the culture that we have going today, or in the ceremonies that we have.
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large, John. We're talking about an exhibit at the Bard Graduate Center. It's running through July 7th of this year. It's at 18 West 86th Street. It's called The Story Box, Franz Boas, George Hunt, and the Making of Anthropology. And my guests are Aaron Glass, who is the exhibition curator, associate professor at Bard Graduate Center, and Corrine Hunt, who is an artist and designer and the great-granddaughter of George Hunt. When we read the book today, aren't there important aspects of the story that we know were left out? Wasn't Boas aware of Canada's colonial assimilation policy?
Yes, he was. So as Corrine mentioned, in 1884, the Canadian government outlawed the potlatch and the other dance ceremonies that are a part of Kwikwaukeeok ceremonialism.
The sort of thing we just heard?
As, the kinds of performance traditions that were represented in that song. This was all part of Canada's efforts to assimilate Native people. It went along with, forced attendance at residential schooling and attempts to eradicate the language, like Corrine mentioned.
Was also religious conversion part of it?
Yeah, absolutely. Part of the driving force behind the ban against the potlatch was missionaries who petitioned the government to help them eradicate indigenous spirituality as part of their efforts to convert. And so Boaz arrives in 1886, 2 years after this. He knows the ceremonies are against the law. And it's really curious that in Boaz's anthropological texts, the very rich, the groundbreakingly rich and detailed description he offers for Kukukuwak ceremony, that which makes it so valuable to people today, like Corrine was talking about, nowhere in there does he mention that the stuff was against the law at the time. Now, Boaz does...
Was he aware?
Absolutely, he was aware. And he also, over the years, he wrote letters of advocacy on behalf of the Kukukuwak and other native people in British Columbia to the government in British Columbia, to the federal government in Canada, defending the potlatch and defending Native people's rights to maintain their ceremonies. But for some reason, Boaz kept his political advocacy writing and his sort of scientific anthropology writing separate. So you would never know from reading this book that all of the stuff, not all of it, a lot of the things that he describes in great detail in the book were actually against the law. And it's important that he was attending ceremonies with George that were technically illegal.
Corrine, the policy was in effect from 1884 to 1951. I'm assuming you were born after that, but was this something that was taught in your schools, that history?
The history, I was born in 1959, and in the schools there was very little that was taught or known to the population in general about the First Nations people. In fact, in this time of reconciliation, it's only recently that the general population has known that there was a ban and that these residential schools were in existence.
So the basic things like ceremonies, language, traditions were all outlawed. You would have thought between 1884 and 1951, they would be pretty much erased. Has that been the case?
No. The wonderful thing is that, we have my grandfather, for example, had potlatched through the ban. We live in a very rugged environment, so not easily accessible except by boat. So I think we had a lot of underground ceremonies, and it was alive and well. In 1920, the government did arrest an entire group during one potlatch and confiscated the masks that were later repatriated to the Umista Cultural Center in Alert Bay. But many people were imprisoned for, 6 months or so. There was a lot of imprisonment going on during the time up until 1951.
So the response was pretty much to hide the ceremonies.
I was going to say that part of that, I think before that the ceremonies were quite lengthy and lasted. There were two parts to the ceremonies, the winter and the summer. And they had to be shortened because of this, and probably they became more social events, more so than today, for example. But no, the ceremonies were never stopped.
One of the things that's interested me as a scholar thinking about this period is thinking about the ways in which Kukukuwak found channels to keep their cultural practice alive during the potlatch ban. And they're in oral history, in communities.
What does potlatch mean? Before we go on, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Because we're talking so everybody knows what potlatch means. Corrine?
Do you want to just start with potlatches?
Yeah, so you can have different potlatches. For example, our family has had a potlatch to memorialize my mother in her passing, and to pass on chieftainships, and all of the songs and dances are passed on through the potlatch ceremony.
So it's pretty much just a name for ceremony, a word for ceremonies.
It's become a kind of catch-all term for a host of different kinds of ceremonies all up and down the coast that have to do with exactly the kind of things Corinne was talking about. You name children, you initiate people, marriage, memorialization. The derivation of the term potlatch comes from this Chinook jargon that I mentioned, from a term that means to give. And the common feature of all of these ceremonies is that at the end of them, the host family, the host chief, gives gifts to the witnesses who have attended and who have seen his family's demonstrations of song and dance and wealth and the business that they had to do. And so that's where the term potlatch comes from, the fact that these gifts were given at the end.
You can go back to what you were saying when I interrupted you. I'm sorry. But I just kept on hearing potlatch and wondering, well, what are we talking about there?
So I've been really interested in the ways that people kept traditions alive during the potlatch ban. And, in communities, there are stories that, Corinne knows and has heard about, they went to the remote villages in the winter when the weather was bad to evade the police. One of the really clever mechanisms was families would go around the village at Christmas time giving gifts to people, apparently Christmas gifts. But, quietly they would be saying, this is a gift to recognize the initiation of my son or to recognize our marriage. So they were taking some of the key functions of the potlatch and concealing them under the veneer of sort of, good Christian Canadian practice.
Because we think of Canada as being a rather enlightened country, and this is a horrifying policy. What kind of justification did they come up with? Killing cultures, because it wasn't just the people of the Pacific Northwest. This was all across Canada. Mm-hmm. The Cree went through the same sort of thing in central Canada.
Yeah. Well, Aaron.
Yes, no, go ahead.
It's a very sort of personal thing for me. John A. Macdonald, who was our first prime minister, referred to us as savages. And even if we became educated, we were still just educated savages. So the Indian Act, which governs all of the Indians in Canada, was a document that was meant to assimilate and or eradicate all First Nations people in Canada.
Do you think
I was just going to say it hasn't happened. Mm-hmm.
Would the reaction to the book have been different if the Canadian policy had been better known around the world?
I don't know. Let me circle back around to that question back through the Chicago World's Fair.
I wanted to get to that now. That was 1893, the Chicago's World's Fair, also known as the World's Columbian Exposition.
Yeah, and I think the fact that – so there were 20 Kukwakiwak. George Hunt led a group of 20 Kukwakiwak who lived at the Chicago World's Fair for 6 months. Boaz was one of the heads of the anthropology department at the fair. It was at the Chicago World's Fair that the term anthropology was introduced to the American public before there were university departments. And so Franz Boaz was there at the start of that. And I think the fact that this group of 20 Kukwakiwak in 1893 agreed to live in Chicago for 6 months and get paid to do dances that they would have been arrested for doing at home was, in fact, one of these mechanisms for helping to keep this stuff alive during the potlatch ban. But I can say that the Canadian government wasn't very happy about it, because newspaper reports of the dances they were doing at the fair got back to Ottawa, and it's there in the archival record that Canadian officials were writing letters back and forth saying, what are we going to do? What are we going to do about, these Kwakiutl people in Chicago giving Canada a bad name? And in fact, 2 years later in 1895, Canada reworded the clause of the Indian Act that prohibited the potlatch to make the prohibiting of dancing and wearing regalia more explicit. And I think it was partially a response to the sort of bad press that Canada felt it got from the Kukwakiwak at the fair.
Ironically, the fair was on the 400th anniversary of Columbus's arrival in America. Boas was working for Harvard's Peabody Museum at that time, in charge of numerous exhibitions about the tribes that were living in North America when Columbus arrived?
Well, he wasn't working directly for the Peabody Museum, but the director of the Peabody Museum, Frederick Putnam, was the head of the anthropology department at the Chicago World's Fair. And Putnam hired Boas to work with him to assemble a collection and to help bring troops of indigenous people. And so Boas sort of subcontracted to George Hunt to bring this group of Kukwakiwak and to make a collection among the Kukwakiwak for the fair.
And Corinne, what do you think was the motivation of the group? Were they getting paid to present their culture and perform the daily tasks for an international audience?
It's interesting. Our group, the villages in the area that I live, were asked, from that time until today, we've been asked to perform our ceremonies or our dances and sing the songs. And it's interesting to me that we have and that people are so interested in it. I think, you know, that it was an important part of our lives. So, you know, to show it in Chicago may have been a way to do that, you know, to say, you know, while there's this force trying to stop it all, that there is an interest in it, keeping it alive.
They must have felt a bit liberated about being able to perform their ceremonial events in a way that they were prohibited from doing at home.
Yeah, I think probably that is true. And the more I learn about the Chicago World's Fair, the more interesting it becomes to me, you know, at a time when people were curious about, you know, these indigenous groups, but then putting them on display and then having this sort of thoroughfare of cultures. But the thing that I learned about this was that, you know, the different cultures that they did have at the Chicago World's Fair, they got to know each other, the different groups of, like the African. Is that true, Aaron?
Yeah, absolutely.
The African people and the Kukwakiwak people. And it just, it's a bit of a wonder to me.
Absolutely. We have photographs in the exhibition of the troupe at the Chicago World's Fair in all their dance regalia. And one of the guys, a guy who was known as Chicago Jim, based on his having been at the fair, is wearing a Haudenosaunee, an Iroquois headpiece, which he probably traded with one of the Iroquoian peoples who were neighbors of theirs in the ethnographic village. And the Kukwakiwak today still do a fun dance at the end of some potlatches called the Sudi, which their ancestors, either at the Chicago World's Fair or the St. Louis World's Fair, learned from the Sioux and introduced into their potlatch dances. So that's one of these, you know, we talk in the exhibition about the kind of three hidden histories of this book. One, George Hunt's co-authorship; two, the potlatch ban; and three, the role of the Chicago World's Fair. And there's so many untold stories about Native people's experience at the fairs.
Why did Boas conceal the fact that much of his fieldwork was conducted in Chicago?
My sense is for the same reason that he concealed George Hunt's contribution, that if people knew that these cultural descriptions were made not in Fort Rupert but in Chicago, that it would question the authenticity and the authority of the descriptions. So he sort of systematically hid the fact that a number of the photographs that illustrate the book, photographs of dances, were taken in Chicago. He painted out, or had someone paint out, the fairground context. We have beautiful examples of this in the exhibit. There's a lot of music recorded in the book, sometimes with lyrics and sometimes with Western musical notation. And what we know now from the archive is that many of those songs were recorded at the fair on wax cylinder. You can hear three of them in the exhibit, including one performed by George Hunt. I think it was just a matter of authenticating the descriptions that the book presents.
Although they, after the fair, they went back to Canada and continued the research. But despite their best efforts, weren't there many errors in the Boas Hunt book? Were they factual mistakes or a failure to fully explain the context of tribal ceremonies?
Yes, to both of those mm-hmm. things. Again, this was the result of Boas's first decade of work among the Kukwakiwak, and a lot of this book represents his first understandings of things that he came to understand more clearly in subsequent years, mostly with Hunt's assistance. But there are also some mistakes. And so this is the other big interesting story of this book and in the exhibit, is that starting in 1920, George Hunt wrote Boas a letter. We have the actual original letter in the exhibit. It's at the American Philosophical Society now. George writes to Franz, and he says, about the book with the many illustrations, there are so many mistakes in the names of the masks and dishes that I think should be put to rights before we die. Boas writes back the next month. We have that letter in the show too. He says, great, take your copy of the book and start writing the corrections in the margins of the book. And miraculously, we also have in the exhibit George Hunt's personal copy of the book with his hand-penciled corrections in the margins.
There's going to be a new edition of the book published. It's going to have those corrections, I assume. You brought an older edition that was published in England. So this became an international bestseller?
Absolutely. This was a hugely important book. The version that I brought is a reprint from the 1970s. And we're working on a new critical edition that will tell these hidden histories of the book's making and then bring George Hunt's corrections and additions and emendations back together with it for the first time.
Corrine, would you say that the Kukwakiwak have a complicated relationship with all the anthropological studies that have been made?
I think there's a lot of it's complicated because George Hunt did a lot of collecting and the understanding of how things were collected, repatriation, and whether or not things were just taken or bought. And I learned from this exhibition actually. That a lot of things were negotiated, and the pieces that were collected were taken when the chief was ready to sell it, after a ceremony, after the winter ceremonies, you can have this piece. So the relationship with anthropologists is ongoing, and I think there's probably not a day when we don't have one in our territory. On the other hand, it has allowed us to have a detailed history of our ceremonies, and we've become my relationship with Aaron, for example, we joke about this exhibit and how I'm the legacy of George Hunt and Aaron is the legacy of Franz Boas, and we're working together much the way George and Franz did back in the day. And so there's room for that kind of work together and working into something like this exhibition.
Boas imagined his book as a storage box for laws and stories. Was he concerned that the culture might disappear because of the Canadian laws?
Because of the Canadian laws in particular, but also Boas was of a generation of anthropologists, of other people who just assumed that Indigenous people were going to vanish under colonial pressures of assimilation, and so he himself felt the urge to salvage, to save for science, for posterity, the remnants of authentic Indigenous culture, and he saw his book as well as museum collections as venues for that saving. And I'd like to invite Corrine to tell the story of the mask that's in the exhibit, which is a case where the information that Boas and then George Hunt recorded in the book ended up now in the present, allowing a revival of a very particular thing.
You reproduced mm-hmm. this mask that originally belonged to your great-grandfather? Or great-grandmother?
Yes, great-grandmother, Lucy. Yeah, so I happened to be in Berlin at the Ethnographic Museum to see this mask and learned about Jacobson and that collection and also about Franz Boas, who was there. So it sort of brought together all of these things that we've heard about in our history, you know, the collectors and the anthropologists. But to see this mask that was collected, in the 1880s or so, that we haven't seen in a ceremony because the mask and the rights to that mask, I think, was lost. So it's a treasure for us to find, and it's the actual design of the mask is quite unique as well. So studying the mask, seeing it in Berlin, and then coming back to the village and working with my cousin Dave Knox on reproducing the mask, you know, we it felt like we were really tying together our history.
So it's in the exhibit at the Bard Graduate Center.
Mm-hmm. It's the kind of spectacular conclusion to the exhibit.
And what has been the reaction of anthropology students to the exhibit?
So far, I've given a number of tours to anthropology students and professors and other scholars. And so far, the reception has been really enthusiastic. I think one of the things people really appreciate is that we take seriously the collaboration of Boas and Hunt, but the exhibit also really reveals the way that anthropology as a way of knowing was made a century ago and is being remade in the present, again, in collaboration with indigenous people. So it's kind of anthropology as a practice is on display as much as Kwakwaka'wakw culture is. And that's very self-conscious. We really wanted to talk about the ways in which Boas and Hunt knew about Kwakwaka'wakw culture and the ways in which Corrine and I and our larger project team working on the critical edition and staff at the Umista Cultural Center, which put the exhibit together with us, the way we're going back to this historic material in the present to make sense of it in new ways to reactivate old collections in ways that are important now.
You mentioned the Umista Cultural Center. That's in Alert Bay, Canada. And that's where the exhibition is going after it closes on July 7th here?
That's right. Very quickly, we're going to...
This is kind of like a finger in the eye of Canada, isn't it?
We're going to pack it up, and we're going to send it back to British Columbia. And exhibit's scheduled to open at the Umista Cultural Center in Alert Bay on July 20th. We hope to great fanfare and with the attendance and participation of a lot of descendants of George Hunt. And it will be the first time that some of these 19th century masks that are pictured in the book that are in museums all over the world will return to British Columbia, at least for the 3 or 4 month run of the show.
Corrine, do you anticipate that the experience of the Kwakwaka'wakw, I'm sorry, I'm mispronouncing it, community
okay.
Visitors will be different from the New Yorkers who have been viewing it here?
Yes, absolutely. So we're going to do a little redesign for the Umista. I think the anthropological side that Aaron is talking about will be less prominent and probably the content itself and the text itself and will be more prominent in the communities where people are eager to, you know, learn the stories and the story about how this book came to be.
When you were designing the exhibition here, was that in the back of your head? This is going to go home as well?
Yes. Yes, it was and it is. I think there'll be two exhibits in one. It would be interesting if we could show how one related to the other, you know, when it goes to Alert Bay, how the differences relate to each other in terms of how George may have related to Boas.
We have very little time left, but we're going to talk about repatriation. Mm-hmm. Can you give us a quick synopsis of the current situation?
So the Umista Cultural Center was created in 1980 to house the repatriated materials that the Canadian government had confiscated in 1921, after the potlatch that Corinne talked about. And so it's been a really the cultural center was at the forefront of movements to repatriate native materials. And we have one object in the show, which was pictured in Boaz's book, which ended up at the National Museum in Canada, not because it was confiscated. It was collected by Boaz himself from Alert Bay in 1889. But when the National Museum in Canada repatriated their confiscated material in 1980, they gifted this piece back to Umista because it was collected by Boaz in Alert Bay. And so that piece is in Umista and will be in the exhibit. And it allows us to tell the story of repatriation. But I just want to say that one of the things that Corinne's mask shows is the way in which the Kukwakiwak can reactivate historical collections by creating new versions of them that are equally authentic to the old ones in museums without the need to repatriate them. So the repatriation is a really important political act in some contexts, and there's other ways that communities can reconnect with their heritage materials, like creating new versions like the mask that Corinne worked on.
The Story Box, Franz Boas, George Hunt, and the Making of Anthropology is currently at the Bard Graduate Center at 18 West 86th Street and runs there until July 17th. My great thanks to Aaron Glass and Corinne Hunt for coming on our show to talk about it.
Thank you for having us.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to Deborah Friedman, who produce this segment.
Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you
on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.